Go. Head on with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head on with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network. Well, howdy!
Planning on it being a busy, busy, busy Thursday evening, but dadgummed if it's not. Warning to sports haters. You might want to go look for a test pattern or something for a couple of minutes, because I'm going to be dealing with some World Cup stuff here in a little bit. But you know what? When it comes to talking about sports, I don't think anybody talks about it quite like we do on the Horn. Because it's not just balls and strikes or goals scored or the how many strokes under par. Sport, as I've said before, is a metaphor for our existence. And I'm feeling kind of good this afternoon. I'll tell you why in a little bit. First things first, though, at 2 minutes past the hour, as we open up this Thursday evening edition of The Horn, an update on the ongoing effort to keep my butt out of the hooscow. You all continue to amaze me. It was Wednesday night when I told you a little bit about the predicament that we find ourselves in here, being the heirs and legatees of a failed septic system and a little bit of good old-fashioned hillbilly feuding, I guess, with some anonymous rotten neighbor bringing the local administrative system to bear on us, necessitating the rather immediate need for me to figure out a way to install an entirely new septic system. You all are amazing. We crossed the $2,000 barrier this morning, and I went out and began marshaling supplies necessary to get the job done in the hopes of having this all taken care of by early July. Like you, in your good graces and your kindness, I'm going forward because you are showing me things that I never dreamed, things that blow my mind to consider about what all of this means to you, and magnifying and amplifying oh so much of what you all mean to me and, in fact, to us here. We have crossed the $2,000 mark, and I am stunned. So thank you. Thank you from the bottom of all of our hearts. I don't know what more to say. I truly don't. There have been a lot of sleepless nights and tears falling off of Agnes's face that made for some pretty grim days around here until I told you all about what we faced. And you have responded amazingly. We are far from the requisite funds to get the entire job done, but I feel confident that we can get the job done just the same because of the kindness, goodness, warmth, and decency you have shown. Just a couple of representative emails of what I've heard from you in the last couple of days. Karen from California writing, Bob, I heard your show last night. I started listening at 9 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Fell asleep close to midnight and didn't turn my computer off. And so at around 2:40 a.m., I heard you speaking about the trouble you're having with your county and the $5,000 repair bill that you have in order to keep your home and livelihood. Bob, you have many friends. The Horn is a community. Those in the community live many miles apart, but we have things in common that make us community. You, like it or not, are the leader of our group. Your wise thoughts and strong voice travel far. The community needs your voice to continue, and we, the community, need to gather together to support you to get that $5,000 bill paid. I do not know a person who is not struggling each month to crack the nut to make ends meet. My friends are like us, working-class folks, trying to survive these difficult economic times. And as we struggle, the earnings of the middle and low-wage earners continue to fall, and the rich get richer upon our weary backs. You were right last night when you said that the right-wing media have strong support from corporations that give them unlimited amounts of funds to do their programming. Sadly, here on the left wing, that is not the case. In the olden days, community would gather together to help raise a barn for a neighbor. I consider your situation the need for a barn raising by your community. The community must now support the Horn. We can meet the July 7th deadline that you have, but we have to do it now. I'm sending in a donation just as soon as I finish this letter to you. If everyone else does this, the funds will multiply one buck at a time. We need your strong voice and activism. My heart is with the Horn community. Best always, Karen in Ventura, California. I read that and I passed the... I called for Agnes and passed the computer to her, and she read it, and she just looked at me, and all she could say was, "Oh, Bob. Oh, Bob." That recognition about what it is to be a community, that recognition about what it is to be working class, and know that we must stand together. What's the old saying? If we do not stand together, we shall surely hang separately. Among the working class, it feels terribly, terribly, terribly apt and very, very true. And I love the idea of a barn raising, because that is how community operates, and it is stunning to see it happen. If you ever get the chance and get your hands on our good friend Jeff Bigger's book, In the Sierra Madre, you will see a written account of a barn raising down there among the Rarimuri people. You will read of it, and it will touch you beyond your imaginings. It is amazing to see this sort of community take place at such great attenuated distance, though. This is the stunning, stunning part. And then this from Faith. Faith, the atheist, in Pittsburgh. I listened to your Tuesday show last night and learned of your dilemma. Please keep us up to date on your situation so that we can keep you out of debtor's prison and in your home and on the air, or rather on the internet. Remember, we don't want to lose you, and I believe it is your obligation to keep us informed. There would be such a hole in my life if we lost you, one of the greatest ever talking heads. You know, I blush easy, and that stuff just really, it's not what I set out to do, to be anyone's leader or to be the best ever at anything. I simply try hard to do what I am able to do, but one of the greatest ever talking heads. I don't know how David Byrne's going to feel about that, but which we won't tell him. It makes no sense, Faith says. It makes no sense to me that you would apologize for needing an increase in your salary. You must put in a new septic tank, and if we want to keep your show alive and well, it is our responsibility to contribute as much as we can. I just sent in a donation this morning, and I think I can send another one within the week. Emails like that have rolled in and rolled in and rolled in. I can't do justice to them all. It has been stunning to behold. Mora wrote at one point, I just sent you $300 for your use, either towards the septic system or for the horn. It's your choice. I only wish that I could afford to do much more. And it has been like that. It has been stunning. $50 just now rolling in. I mean nothing crass by this, but I don't think I've ever seen such a manifestation of what this all means. And I don't mean in dollar terms. I mean the comments that come along with all of this. Going back to Michael's note last night, use $100 for the Horn yacht and $100 for the Learjet. But we are getting there, and we are going to get this done. David writing in, another and new member of the Davids. Just heard about the current situation and your touching letter from a listener. Read the barn raising. Just got paid today, what I have for now, but look for another installment in a few minutes as soon as I send this off to you. This is mind-boggling. It is absolutely stunning to me. And I stand in your debt, and I stand stunned by your goodness, we all do, forevermore. And I guess it's, some would say, hey, Bob, don't do what you're about to do, but I'm going to do what I'm about to do anyway, because there is a stark relief between what you are doing to keep what we do here going and the other side. And I think it is more than fitting, that there be some sort of visceral reminder of what this program and this radio network exist to oppose, of what we exist to counter, however we may. For as long as the fight remains in us, we struggle, and you are doing such beautiful things, keeping us going here in this little ramshackle house, in this little studio, this little sauna in the hills. You are doing so much to keep this going. The goodwill is absolutely. It's like being touched by lightning. It is like being feeling the power of a mighty and cleansing current washing over one. And it stands in stark opposition to this. I got emails from David in Tennessee and from Sandra just a little bit ago. Sandra writing in. Subject line, when, oh when? Dear Bob, God, I can't wait for this fat F to die. And a link. And then from David in Tennessee. Oh, look. The round mound of pharmacology was married 10 days ago. Big party. What am I saying? Great party. Elton John on piano. Away for a week or 10 days, and now he's home, his new bride in tow. And now he's saying wilder, more evil shit than ever. Shouldn't he be living on a cloud of newly wedded bliss? Well, he ain't. He wants hungry kids to dumpster dive. He steals the mock Malia bit from Beck. What is it? Laying next to a woman, or maybe just having one under the same roof, stealing your bliss flush? And what this is all about is the following. While you struggle, and I struggle, and we all struggle together, we work toward a common goal of keeping all of this going. The $40 million man is pumping out quality broadcasting like this.
Record number of U.S. kids facing summer of hunger. With the school year ending in communities across America, more than 16 million children face a summer of hunger. Now, Michelle Obama told us they're all so fat and out of shape and overweight that a summer off from government eating might be just the ticket.
See how he sets up the false premise? First of all, he says that it's Michelle Obama's fault for pointing out that we have a terrible, terrible obesity problem in this country. That leads to the idea that maybe if children would starve, where's Reverend Hagee when you need him? Starve! If children would starve for 3 months, that it would do them some good. But shameless apologist for corporate America that he is, and the corporate world for that matter, fat, jiggling, flush flimball, and I say that as a guy who is fat and jiggles in his own right, not like I'm living in a glass septic tank throwing stones. Oh, well, there was one that didn't need to be said during dinner, but anyway. He doesn't understand that obesity does not come from eating too much. That it can come from having, for instance, high fructose corn syrup instead of reasonably honest, and I know there are people out there, white sugar's poison, Bob! I know. But that stuff is at least metabolized in your intestines. Whereas high fructose corn syrup, whether it be in your soda pop, your popsicles, or your damn tomato soup, thanks, Richard, that stuff gets metabolized in your liver, just like booze, and it does the same things to your liver as booze. And it contributes to obesity because it doesn't act on the centers of your brain that go, hey, dummy, you're full now, the way ordinary nutrients do. But Flush doesn't know that. He just thinks that the poor people are fat because they're lazy.
Could it be possible? While classes were in session, they relied on free or discount. And this, of course, takes into no account that the parents, I guess, just have to sit around and let their kids starve. Why, if the kids don't do it, they're going to starve.
Anybody remember that last great Mel Brooks movie that featured Howard Morris as Pepto? The rich guy who tried to go out and live on the streets. It was a very funny movie, but it was also a very, very serious one at the same time. Well, I do. And, see, Flush needs to go out and live, $40 million man that he is, Flush needs to go out and live for a month on food stamps. Flush needs to go out and live for a month on $3 a day. You know, where a banana will break your ass. And by the way, while he's bitching about school foods, do you know what he's carping about? This conservative with his family values, recently married by a family values homophobic preacher, who tried to run a hustle to get his parishioners to help him take control of Microsoft? Hello? Ken Hutcherson? Yeah, the food that Flush is complaining about, if you remember back a couple of years ago, we found out something. We found out something incredibly disturbing. We found out that the food that our children are eating in schools, purchased by the USDA for the school lunch program, often consists of meat that comes from things called downer cattle. And it doesn't mean it's some Guernsey in the corner of the feedlot going, "Oh, what a bummer. No, y'all go on without me. I'll be okay." No, that's not what a downer cow means. It is a cow that has become so sick inside the confines of the Cowschwitzes and the Dachau's of the contained animal feedlot operations, CAFOs, that it can no longer stand on its own legs. And it collapses and is picked up with a forklift and taken to slaughter. School lunch meats consist of meat that may very well at one point in time, to one degree or another, have contained mad cow. But even that is too good for America's working poor, where Flush Flimball is concerned.
If the schools don't do it, the kids are going to starve. The children caught in a gap will likely spend the next few months caging leftovers from their neighbors.
Caging, you dumbass!
Chopping down on cheap junk, lining up with their families at food banks. They're already overmatched or simply learning to live with a constant headache, growling stomach, and chronic fatigue. When school rolls around again in the fall, they'll be less healthy and less ready to learn than their peers.
God. Do you know why? Do you know why this bothers Flush Flimball? This bothers Flush Flimball because I think what tiny little molecule of conscience he may yet have remaining tweaks him when he sees these stories, and his natural inclination, because he is a conscienceless sociopath for the most part, is to lash out at those most in harm's way because of his massive consumption and massive ego. God, wouldn't I like to buy Rush Limbaugh for what he's worth and sell him for what he thinks he's worth. Here in the hills, we have a word for the Rush Limbaughs of the world. He's a blivet. Flush Flimball is a blivet. And for those of you who don't live around here and have never heard the word, a blivet is roughly defined as 10 pounds of shit stuffed into a 5-pound onion bag. Ever seen an onion bag? You don't want to try to carry that in it, especially overstuffed. I think you get the image.
This is just we can't escape these people. We just can't escape them.
No, Rush, you can't, you dumbass, because the Bible says, you know, Jesus, the guy who watched over your family values wedding, while Elton John tinkled away on the old 88, and you were officiated over and introduced to God Almighty as a couple wedded forever in bliss by a family values evangelical minister. Yeah, Jesus said, and maybe you're just echoing Jesus, Rush. Jesus said, "The poor ye have always with ye." The late, great Kurt Vonnegut thought that was an example of Jesus popping a one-liner. I personally think it was Jesus recognizing reality. He didn't say why the poor ye have always with ye. He merely acknowledged the fact. There are ways to keep from having the poor always with ye. There's always the handy-dandy Zyklon B-powered gas oven. But on the other side, on the more humane side, there is perhaps the possibility we might look for ways at ending poverty. We have it within our hands. We have it within our means on this planet today. Because of production, because of excess, we have it within our means that there should never be a single child on this planet go to bed hungry. Or adult, for that matter. Or nursing mother. It is within our power. But sadly, because predatory, profit-driven, wholly profit-driven corporations run this planet, sadly, while it is within our power, it is outside our will.
They live in the utter deniability of basic human nature. They actually have it in their heads somehow that parents are so rotten that they will let their kids go hungry and starve. Unless the schools take care.
Parents are so rotten they will let their kids go hungry and starve. Understand, of course, that Flush Flimball has never known a hungry day in his life. He was the son of a wealthy lawyer who was the son of a wealthy lawyer. He comes from a wealthy family in southeastern Missouri. They say Missouri down there. And everything has always been provided for Flush Flimball. He has never had to honestly work a day in his life. He's never painted a wall. He's never roofed. He's never hauled asphalt shingles up a rickety ladder. He has never worked a day in his life except to sit behind a microphone and spew filth and hate. Because even if you go back and you listen to his earliest air check days, you can hear the dribbling sarcasm, even when he was only calling out the names of the last record he'd played or talking about how much snow was going to fall in Pittsburgh. It's there. It's there. He thinks that parents let their children starve.
Well, Muriel, let's go off to the casino and let the kids starve today.
No. It happens all over the planet, and yes, it happens in the United States, where parents look by helplessly while their children's bellies do rumble. And when they feed them what's available to them, because there are no real stores around them, say, in certain parts of cities in the United States. Nothing but little corner bodegas and the like, where you can get a bag of potato chips or Doritos or some such and a bottle of pop. But you're not going to buy any fresh green beans or cauliflower, broccoli or carrots. And God knows you ain't going to have the money to be buying no roast beast.
I had some hope. I did. I had some hope. God was passing out the lightning bolts the last couple of days, and I thought maybe he'd finally come around and started paying attention.
But as long as this goes on, no. He's back to sloughing on the job.
You know, one of the benefits of school being out, and in addition to your kids losing weight because they're starving to death out there because there's no school meal being provided. One of the benefits, school being out, college camp high being vacant this time of year, is that our audience levels go up. And you know what we're going to do here? We're going to start a feature on this program, Where to Find Food, for young demographics. Where to find food. Now that school is out, where to find food. We can have a daily feature on this. And this will take us all the way through the summer. Where to find food. And, of course, the first will be try your house. It's a thing called the refrigerator.
Because just like Bud Light ads, refrigerators are always full.
I am truly challenged
to manifest the disdain. And yes, even though it is somewhat consumptive, yes, 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 a thousand times yes, the hatred I feel for this man. The first thing we're going to do is the refrigerator. Try the refrigerator!
You can almost hear the fried chicken stuck in my throat.
The first one is going to be, try the refrigerator, but that's okay. Wait till you hear what comes next.
You probably already know about it. Try looking there. There are also things in what's called the kitchen of your house, called cupboards.
And what do you do, Rush, if you don't have a house to have a kitchen in or a refrigerator in said kitchen? Because, you know, we do have these people in our country. They're called homeless. That guy, Ken Hutcherson, who officiated at your wedding, pretends to talk to a lot. You know, Jesus. Jesus talked a lot about homeless people. Only the thing is, he didn't advocate talking about them the way you're talking about them, Flush, or treating them the way you want to treat them. Okay, mean little moment on Bob's part. There are a few people, it's a list, I admit, it's a list. I keep a list. It's just sort of mentally cleansing for me. I've got a list of people that I'd like to stand and just kneel down by their bedside and whisper in their ears as they gasp their last. Do you feel the flames on your heels yet, Rush? Do you hear those fluttering bat wings? Is the heat beginning to rise in your body, Rush? You're on the way to hell, Rush. And maybe you'll be tormented by little children with ribs showing through their skin. Maybe they'll eat you, Rush. Forevermore, Rush.
And in those cupboards, most likely, you're going to find ding-dongs, Twinkies, Lay's Ridgy potato chips, all kinds of dip.
Okay, was he paid to say this? He never says that. He doesn't do product placement without being paid for it. Is there a public commercial? Is there a public campaign started yet to talk to the Ding Dongs people and the Lay's potato chips people and let them know that they're being used by Flush Flimball to mock the very class of people that eat their products? Folks who have access to junk food but not good food? I'll never forget hearing Dick Gregory speak when I was at West Virginia University as a very young man. And he said, man, you don't have to be skinny to be malnourished. He said, look at these fat executives. They're malnourished too. That's why they got high cholesterol. That's why they got high triglycerides. That's why all their vitamins and their minerals are out of whack. Maybe malnutrition, for all his millions, maybe malnutrition is ruining Rush Limbaugh's brain. Lord knows it would be nice if there was some sort of something you could point to so that there might be a cure. But somehow I doubt it.
And maybe a can of corn that you don't want. But it will be there. If that doesn't work, try a Happy Meal at McDonald's. You know where McDonald's is.
Because they give away the Happy Meals at McDonald's. They just give them away. They're free, right?
There's the dollar menu at McDonald's. And if they don't have Chicken McNuggets, dial 911 and ask for Obama. There's another place, if none of these options work, to find food. There's always the neighborhood dumpster. Now, you might find competition with homeless people there, but there are videos that have been produced to show you how to healthfully dine and how to dumpster dive.
How are they going to watch the videos, Rush? I'm just asking. Because if Mama and Daddy can't feed them, they damn sure can't pay an internet bill now, can they? Sorry, the YouTube's gonna be kinda useless, isn't it?
That's enough of that filth. That is enough of that filth. Yeah, I'm liking this idea. What do you think? What do you think? What is your vision of hell for Rush Limbaugh? What would hell be if you got to dictate eternal torment for Rush Limbaugh? Might those little devils I was talking about a little bit ago, might they force-feed school lunches to flush all the live-long day through, make the fat man eat all day long, all night long, for all eternity, till he pops? Kind of like in Seven? Think he might, yeah. Maybe in hell there's a little corner where you take gluttons like Flush Flimball and you give them the foie gras treatment and you just stuff the funnel down their throats past their gag reflex, which I'm told, based on his conduct in the Hill District of Pittsburgh many years ago, he has already learned to control on his own. Just stuff the funnel down past his gag reflex and pour the food in constantly. Constantly. You begrudged. Here, Rush, here's all the food you ever begrudged anyone on Earth. Breakfast is forever. So is lunch. And so is dinner, Flush. Eat it all, Flush. And don't worry, after you explode in agony, we'll reconstitute you and start you over again. Or maybe after you're fattened up, we'll roast you for a little while and let the little demons eat you before we reconstitute you. Sometimes that kind of stuff is a little bit cleansing. But yeah, that is enough of that filth. But there was more filth. And you know, this is pathetic filth. And it's pathetic for Flush Flimball, not because of content. The content is noxious enough. But there you sit, the $40 million man, and you are forced, as David in Tennessee noted a little bit ago, you are forced at this point in your career as the king of talk radio, you are forced to rip off Glenn Beck. Oh, that's sad, Flush. Are you back on the junk yet?
This morning Barack Obama wakes up, heads into the bathroom and starts shaving. A door opens. A little daughter comes in.
Daddy, did you shake down PP yet, Daddy?
Do you notice the voice? That is the same identical mocking voice that Beck used to mock little Malia Obama. He didn't even try to make it his own. It is a dead lift. He's down to stealing from Glenn Beck.
Can I make him pay, Daddy? Or you gonna make BP pay, Daddy? Did you plug the hole yet, Daddy? Daddy, did you plug the hole? Daddy, who's in charge of the Gulf oil spill? Daddy, what's your golf handicap today, Daddy? How's your golf game, Daddy?
Golf handicap? From the guy who spent 8 years supporting, we're gonna find Osama. Now watch this drive. Oh, I hope, you know, all those little demons, I hope they all talk exactly like that. Exactly. Ron and Raleigh writing in, hey, Bob, so the porcine purveyor of prevarication thinks that people go hungry because they're too stupid to look in the fridge? Bob, what kind of woman would marry this swollen excuse for a human being? I am not by nature a violent man, but it would take every ounce of restraint to keep from beating him to within an inch of his life. The curse of King Midas would be appropriate. You know, King Midas, everything he touched turned to gold. Yeah, I think in Russia's case, everything should turn to bacon. Bacon. Oh, I love bacon. Bacon. And that's just a starting place tonight. Jiminy Christmas. So then there's this. We take a break. And we take a break remembering the profound career of Gary Scheider, a founding member of Funkadelic. George Clinton always said, no Scheider on guitar, no Funkadelic. Yeah, this is for Rush. This is for the kids that Rush finds so humorous. This is the horn. And we will be right back with your calls.
Hey, Smoothers. Yeah. Tell me something good. Let's take it to the stage, sucker.
Have no fear.
Get on.
Mac Funk is here. Doing it to the max. Laughing at ya.
Get it on.
Yeah. Everybody funkin' and don't know how. They should have seen the bull when he funked the cow. He funked it so hard, they saw some smoke. He said, let's get in bed and funk like folks. Laughing at ya. Funk used to be a bad word. Say it loud. I'm funkin' out proud. Talking about you, the godfather, godmother, grandfather. They call us the funk mob. The Miss Muffet sat on the tuffet, smelling some TAC. Mom came aside and slid down beside her. Say, what's in the bag, bitch? She said, I'm laughing at ya. Funk used to be a bad word. Motherfuck you. Hit God. Earth, hot air, and no fire. In your loose boots.
Let's take it to the stage from Funkadelic. And, you know, also in memoriam, that song for Gary Scheider, founding member of Funkadelic, diagnosed with cancer in March of this year. He went on to that funky place today. Let's go to the phones. See what's cooking. See what's going on in your world, in your mind. Hey, welcome to the program.
Where do I begin? The reason I'm calling in is dear old Rush. first of all, as I'm sure everyone who's listening, because they're intelligent, is aware, you can be fat and poor and not overeat.
Absolutely.
Be just poor. It's called starch, because starch is cheap.
Starch is cheap, indeed.
Yes.
Hence, very potatoes,
cheap.
Rice, wheat, barley,
yeah.
Oats, rye. The very origins of large gatherings, large agglomerations or conglomerations or whatever of humanity, the formation of cities, if you will, begins with the ability to create or to produce massive amounts of starch grains.
Yeah. And actually, though, that isn't what really, really got me mad. It's if you start surfing the web, you're going to find learned papers by various scientists that, although they don't come right out and say it, they intimate it, that due to the sheer volume of the crap we walk around in every day, be it heavy metals, pesticides, all this other insane, you know, high fructose corn syrup, all that other
mac crap. And cheese.
The sheer volume of metabolic disorders, which used to be incredibly rare in the U.S. population, is just going through the roof.
Well, you know, one of the things that Dr. Sandra Steingraber mentions in Living Downstream, somewhere along the way, she mentions, if I had an award to give for the human body's most gullible system, she says it would be the endocrine system, because it is so easily fooled by chemicals into thinking it's getting something it's not.
Yeah.
And it acts accordingly.
Yeah. But, you know, it's like me personally. Here's an example. I can be classified as morbidly obese, which means I'm well over 100 pounds overweight. I do not overeat. I never have overeaten. My favorite foods are vegetables. However, I did not come from a gene pool. I came from a cesspool, and I was given...
Don't be so hard on yourself, and more importantly, Susan, quit being so hard on your forebears. I
was given a genetic present from my mother that gave me a metabolic disorder. One of the side effects of it is obesity. You either have obesity or anorexia. And my type of...
Well, that's a hell of a choice.
Disorder. Yeah, ain't it, though? My particular type of this disorder came out to be obesity. So I'm over 100 pounds overweight. I'm on a medically mandated diet. I'm allowed a whole 45 grams of protein a day. Whoopee.
Don't eat it all in one place.
But, you know, and that includes things like broccoli and stuff like that. But you can't have that kind of a diet and overeat. Not possible.
No, see, that's what makes Flimball such a hateful thing, because... What bothers me the most out of that, it's, you know, there's lots of hateful people on the planet. And it's not confined to white folks or black folks or brown folks or any other folks. There's just hateful people on the planet, Susan. But it's hateful people who are allowed to use the public airwaves that you and I own in order to spread this ignorant garbage, because he doesn't take into account any of those things. He just hates children for having lunch. You know, this, yeah. Oh my God, he hates people for he hates children for getting lunch at school.
Yeah. One of the things that really concerns me about this is, okay, I'm in my 60s. Hey, I am not going to drop dead if Flush Limbaugh proceeds to come off and go off into a ill-bred rant. I consider the source. But consider a 10-year-old who is overweight through no fault of their own, who's fighting a medical condition, who can't help it, and then they hear what this crap, what this creep is putting out. What is that going to do to them?
I can't believe, begin to express that.
How many kids are going to, I'll put it bluntly, how many kids are going to go out and commit suicide because of what this asshole says?
Yeah, or develop some other eating disorder. And this thing has a double whammy, and I don't just do this to get people enraged. This is about consciousness building, Susan. This is about awareness. Because the only way we can fight back against this filth is by recognizing it and knowing it and then talking it. Because, see, that's the thing about this public airwaves thing. 4 million people, or some significant portion thereof, heard that, and a whole bunch of them went, yeah, it's them fat poor people's fault. They're fat and poor. And then a bunch of evangelicals whipped out their King James Version and said, yeah, there it says, the poor you have them always with you. Don't say you got to feed them. Yes, it does. You're reading the wrong part of the book.
Yeah, and some kid who through no fault of his own, is overweight, whose parents dragged him into a mega church, is all of a sudden going to get blasted with that crap. And his parents aren't going to support him. And what's going to happen? Pre-adolescent and adolescent children are horribly vulnerable to this. I know because I've been there. I've got the suicide attempts to prove it. And I don't want them to have to do what I have to go down the road I went. They might actually succeed.
Well, you see, Susan, he's a jackal. And maybe that's my mistake in presuming human conduct from a jackal. And maybe that's being hard on the jackals. I could say that he's a dung beetle, but, you know, dung beetles do honorable work. There's nothing honorable in the work that Flush Flimball does.
I put him in the same category as I do as the CEO of BP.
Actually, if we're going to work that Dante's Inferno Rings of Hell, I keep moving Flush on down a few levels because Tony Hayward doesn't get behind a microphone and do it every day. This is deliberate, conscious, willful conduct.
Yeah, and I don't know whether he believes it or not. If he does, I pity him. I really do. And I do know one thing. I know a really good hell for him.
Oh, do.
My version of hell is for him to be utterly and totally, completely forgotten.
Yeah, sometimes I don't want to go the places that David in Tennessee's brain goes. He just noted, he said, now in defense of Flush, if kids are truly hungry more often, the kids are more likely to come over to his limo, you know, when he stops in the middle of the block and rolls down the window and motions the boy in the tight jeans over to the car.
Yeah, and if they get too hungry, they can always just say, hey, little girl, come here. I've got a knife. And
yeah.
Reach for the knife. You know, what the hell? Little cannibalism among friends. Yeah. People like that just don't.
No, they don't.
Tar and Feathers comes to mind.
Rail. Yes.
Yes.
See, that's the thing. Maybe it's a good, you know, I would guess that among Flush's demographic, there are very few of the people that he mocks listening. And it's a good thing because one of them might decide to hunt him down and have a little fun.
Well, I really sincerely hope that some kid of a listener, you know, some child of a listener doesn't hear that and do something drastic because
well, if that happens, then I have tremendous apologies to make. And I share your hope.
Because they will turn around, that ditto head will turn around and they'll kill him. Because they're not too tightly wrapped to begin with. I'm losing a kid, you know, you're not gonna, you know,
No, I know where you're going. I understand.
Yeah.
Susan,
I appreciate
your thoughts, and I appreciate you sharing that candid part of your life. I really do.
Well, it was a bad time, but I managed to get through it. But it's, you know, it's just, it's something, sometimes, you know, sure people can be fat because they overeat. But a lot of times, they don't have a choice. So before you start making fun of or making judgments, find out, or better yet, ask yourself, do I have a right to make a judgment? Because, frankly, I don't think anybody does.
And, you know, I guess I have to respect Barack Obama for not responding to either Beck or Limbaugh, looking nervously over his shoulder, knowing that he's significantly older than Beck and that he will be buried by Beck, and therefore copying and ripping off Beck. I guess I got to respect Barack Obama for not responding to either of those filth merchants, because God knows I couldn't not take the bait. I'd rise to that like a trout to a fly.
Yeah, I don't know how he's doing it. If it was my kid that was being him.
But see, that's the other side of that coin, Susan, and that is he's got to know. He's got to know that this kind of stuff is being said. And at the same time, he persists in reaching out to the right wing to make it better for them.
Yeah.
You know, look at this act of appeasement that went on with cutting slack to the NRA. Did you see this story? Now, this isn't Obama, but this is the Democrats in Congress. It's being called a carve-out. There's this piece of legislation out there called the Disclose Act. And it forces, in the light of the Citizens United decision, it compels organizations to tell where the money's coming from and what they're funding and how they're funding it. And it applies to everybody, corporations, unions, nonprofits, whatever. But lo and behold, in the middle of the consideration of the Disclose Act, Susan.
Yeah.
Democrats, not Republicans. Democrats pushed a change in the Disclose Act that would, and this is the language, quote, exempt organizations from disclosure requirements if they have more than 1 million members, raise no more than 15% of their funds from corporations, and have existed for more than 10 years.
In other words, the NRA.
In other words, the NRA. Lily-livered. And, of course, it also applies to the Humane Society and the AARP. Yeah. But see, the Humane Society and the AARP aren't out there trying to eliminate political candidates from office.
Oh, they've spotted the first
it was,
whale.
Oh, yuck. Fred Wertheimer of Democracy 21 was on a conference call about the Disclose Act.
He was involved in drafting the legislation, and he said it was written to be as narrow an exemption as possible. It was written for the NRA. Because if you ever drive, if you're ever driving out of D.C. and you're heading west on I-66, there's a big old mirrored glass building off on the left around Fairfax somewhere, or maybe it's out around Manassas, and it just says three big blood red letters on the corner of the building, NRA. And it's, you know, 8-10 stories tall, and it's chock full of people working hammer and tongs around the clock to intimidate politicians.
I think I saw a headline. That's the one where the right wingers are blasting the NRA for, quote, selling out.
But there's no. This is done exclusively for the NRA. The NRA is.
Yeah, I know. I don't understand that. The whole thing is just. That's why. That's one of the reasons Congress is just so crappy in the polls, because they turn around and they just say, "Here I am, rape me," you know.
Do me.
Have your way with me.
You.
Do me. Yeah.
I know, Susan. Thank you very much. Have yourself a good night.
Yeah, and give my love to Agnes.
Sure will. You take care.
Okay. One of the reasons why I did what I did, besides having someplace to rant and rave and keep myself sane, is because if it weren't for the horn, I wouldn't have found a sister.
She feels the same way. She does. She does.
Blessed be.
You too, Susan. You too. Take care. Bye. News Ninja Susan calling from Columbia City, Oregon. Let's take a little break. Apparently, we have started something here. A track being suggested from Ron and Raleigh. He said, music certainly lost one of the best, and offers this as we go into our top of the hour break, a little something from George Clinton. Can you imagine Flush Flimball hearing this song and not exploding? Maybe that's all it takes. Sonic Warfare, just drive by his house and play this a few times, because it's already making him crazier than a sprayed roach. That's half of what most of this stuff is. This is America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn.
delay versus pro-choice. I pledge allegiance to the flag, being all I could never be.
Damn, you just told me.
Yeah, this is USAK all day, and you can't interrupt, laid back.
Why, sir?
Stars and stripes for the tars and types. Got brothers like me behind bars and on pipes. Damn, I'm getting took for a trip. They got me seeing stars from the club and stripes from the whip. Why must y'all be like that? I ain't into politics, so skip them white collar tricks. They never did us no good. To hell with the space shuttle. Put some money in the hood and make jobs. Let's mob up to the capital. Then we ain't gotta wrap it all. Power to the people, and the only way to get free is the J to the U S T I C E.
Picture this, paint a picture, paint a fucking picture.
Y'all can't stop the bump run, so get the paint run. It's time for a change. Bill Clinton.
Bill Clinton?
Hell no, I'm talking about George Clinton.
The White House black brown.
All man look only a different color. In a different time, you have to help your neighbor. Look at the downtown area. No food to eat, no shelter. The people have to live in a house made of paper. And when it rains, it falls through like the wire. Hunger, the hunger all over.
Thinking ahead means preparing for the future of our children, our grandchildren, and our wild, wonderful West Virginia. Developing our renewable energy resources is the best way to ensure a clean, sustainable way of life and safe, good-paying jobs for generations to come. Here in the Mountain State, our most abundant energy resource is the wind. Our ridges and majestic mountain peaks shape and direct the wind like stones in a mountain stream. Coal River Mountain is the ideal place for developing wind power. The Coal River Mountain Wind Farm will provide us with a source of clean energy and good jobs forever. We have the power to make our future happen now. Be a part of the clean energy solution for West Virginia by visiting coalriverwind.org or call 304-854-2182. That's coalriverwind.org, 854-2182.
We know you want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95.
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance, and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
Eleven and a half past the hour on this Thursday evening here in the hills and hollers of wild, wonderful, almost level West by God, Virginia. I'm Bob. This is The Horn. And email rolling in right quickly like... Jim writing in,
So is Rush supposed to be a friend of Dorothy? That's what rumor has, that he was busted for gay pandering in the Hill District as Jeff Christie, rock and roll disc jockey, in his Pittsburgh days. That's why he had to go off to Kansas City and work for the Royals for a while. Jim says, regarding his gag reflex, I'd just as soon have a rendezvous with a goat. You know, and that's the thing. When it comes to, right down to it, Rush probably would, too. There's, you know, look, your Mrs. You know, he's got the new Mrs. Rush now with a 7.3-pound the prenup. But the nice thing is, if you marry Rush and you're a woman, you don't ever have to worry about him ever trying to find that thing and put it to use with you. So, you know, you've got that going for you. You take, you know, you sit there and you tolerate it for 10 years, and then you bail out like Marta and the other one did, and you take the cat and you leave him in 26,000 square feet with a cat, and you're made for life. Still, it must take a mighty special kind of woman to be able to marry up with the likes of that filth. And now remind me, because I want to extend this, and it's not more Rush and it's not more Beck. I want to take this in a slightly different direction and let you hear what it sounds like when the people who know which fork to use with the shrimp talk about this kind of stuff. I really want you to hear this. And later on in the evening, I just, based on my life lately, and you know a part of it, and based on also our mention of Big Butter Jesus, which apparently was wanting for lightning rods, a reading this evening, a reading from that greatest of American prophets, Mr. Samuel Langhorne Clemens, a reading later this evening. Hopefully we will have time for it. But to the phones right now, and Juanita is with us. Hey, Juanita. Hey, what's up?
When I was a little girl, they had what they call Lifesavers, not the candy, but, you know, Merita bread. They used to make, like, cakes and...
Oh, yeah, Merita, sure.
And this was like cinnamon buns, and you'd get a whole big package for a nickel. That's how long ago it was. And they call them Lifesavers because they would fill you up, you know, and...
Make you feel like you weren't hungry.
Right. And my folks, you know, they were able to do a lot of working on those Lifesavers. But...
And again, pure starch, pure sugar.
Yeah. Yeah, and... I wanted to say something about... Well, I'm going to say something about Rush, and I want to say something about Obama, too.
Okay. Say both.
Okay. I thought about my grandmother used to... She was came to live with us when I was real little, and my folks worked a lot. You know, had to work a lot, you know, to keep a roof over your head.
Right.
Anyway, she would teach me parables from the Bible. And the one that she taught a lot about, she talked about it, was Lazarus and the rich man. You remember that one?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well, come on down a number of years, and do you remember the musical and also movie Godspell?
Sure. Absolutely.
Did you ever see the movie?
Movie, no. I've seen the stage play.
Yeah, I saw the stage before I ever saw the movie, but they had a little thing on Lazarus and the rich man on the parable. And when Lazarus died, you know, he went up to be with Abraham, and he got to eat all the hot dogs he wanted. He was just eating hot dogs like it was going out of style, you know. It was so, you know, made it so real. And, of course, Lazarus, he was down, you know where, and I mean, not Lazarus, but the rich man. And he was wanting just him to put a drop of water on his tongue. But I always remember that, and I think about that when I hear Rush. And, you know, some of these people...
Well, and you know, that brings something to mind, Juanita, because maybe that's ultimately what I've got in mind, because and this is I didn't invent this. I've heard this before, frankly, from Agnes. She used to say, "Well, I'd stand at the gates of hell and tease them with ice water."
Yeah, that's good.
That's it. Yeah, that's right. Just have him sitting there panting, just panting like an old blue tick hound. And hey, look at the ice cube brush. Oh, doesn't it look cool and refreshing?
Yeah.
Oh, you missed. Oh, that drop almost
and
hit your tongue.
When you're thirsty, boy, that does just sound good, you know. You ever be somewhere where you got real thirsty, you know?
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think everybody's had that to happen. But anyway. He's funny. I have a theory about why he's doing that about Obama's little girl. Because he knows, unlike Glenn Beck, he can get away with it without anybody saying anything to him, you know, that's in his bunch. You know, just like he said the word mentally retarded. And, you know, remember all the hoopla that Sarah had about that?
Yep.
But when Rush did it, oh, she said he meant it in a different way.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, he's a comedian.
Uh-huh. So, you know what I'm saying? And I think he's just showing that he can get away with mocking and doing what Glenn Beck did. But Glenn Beck, you know, he kind of had an answer for it. And you know what I'm saying?
Yes, yes.
I think it makes sense that that's what Russia, you know, was doing. But anyway, what I want to say about Obama was about the speech. I was last night on Rachel Maddow. I don't know if you heard it or not, but...
Didn't have a chance, no.
She gave her interpretation of what she wished that he would have said. And it was just wonderful. She ought to
write. So she wasn't particularly thrilled with it either.
No. Uh-uh. No. But anyway, I think, and then I saw Janine Garofalo. She was on, I've got to where I watch Joy Behar's show on CNN.
Mm-hmm.
And she had Janine Garofalo and Ron Reagan Jr. And they're absolutely, she was like, I think you were saying about Salazar. She said she didn't know why that Obama appointed Salazar to that position. She said he is one of the most right-wing Democrats there was in Congress.
Without a doubt, yes, he was. I mean, he was an apologist for the oil industry.
But there, and I'm thinking about, see, I haven't heard her in quite a while, and I have heard Ron, but I haven't heard her in quite a while, and she's saying some of the same things that you're saying, you know, and we're saying. She's getting the same vibe about it. But what, when I heard his Obama speech, was the part, you know, where he said about the prayer. You know what made me think of?
What?
Who's that woman? She's so fliffily fluffy. She wrote most of Reagan's speeches, you know.
Peggy Nooner? I mean, Peggy
yeah.
Noonan?
She's so nauseatingly sweet. And that reminded me of something that she would have written.
Yeah, it did. It had that.
Yeah,
and frankly, it was a finger in the eye to 20% of America.
Right, and to me, I think if he was going to say something like that, then what would have been wiser on his part was him saying what he believed, not like trying to be all-inclusive of everybody and excluding many people. Because you take, everybody's got a different, even people, believers like me, they've got a different concept of how to pray, you know what I'm saying, or what to have faith about.
Yeah, do the Muslim, well, you know, and it brings up a bunch of questions. You know, Newt Gingrich was so glad to see that he was acknowledging a larger God. I don't know, larger than Big Butter Jesus? I'm not sure. But he was acknowledging a larger God. Does that? So when he's telling America to pray, is it okay for the Muslims to pray too? How about the Hindus? You know, what if the Jains want to pray? Do those prayers count too?
Who?
The Jains and the Hindus and the Buddhists and the Muslims and the animists and the Wiccans. Do all of those prayers count too, Juanita? You know,
well, the thing is that. I noticed that when I used to watch Bill Maher's show when he was on ABC, that most of the right wing, you know, that consider themselves Christians, including Ann Coulter, and with her little short skirts up to her, you know what?
Yeah, and her big old Adam's apple.
Yeah, and they assumed that they were the only ones that had any knowledge of faith. And I know one time one of them said to Bill, well, you know, you're an atheist. And he said, no, I'm not. I'm not an atheist. He said, I just don't believe in organized religion. He said, I believe in God. He said, Jesus is a great, you know.
Right.
But, you know, but they assume that nobody but them has any kind of knowledge of what is right or wrong. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, I do. Well, that's because they are, you know, a lot of them really are wanting. They really are sociopaths. They don't have a conscience. They are unable to consider the well-being of others.
You know that if Rush had any kind of conscience, he wouldn't dare tread where he's treading. Because this wasn't a parable that Jesus told about treating his little ones, what, you know, be better that they had a big thing hung around their neck and be cast into the sea. And he didn't say that was a parable. I don't think.
No, he wasn't speaking metaphorically then.
Yeah. But I tell you, little spirits I had about the food, you know, and the free food for children. Anyway, I had gotten some for my son, and his friend kept telling him, said, people like you are causing everything to be up for everybody else, you know, like he had bought into that right-wing line. And, but the thing is that I got the idea about getting the food for my son from his mother. I was right with his mother when she went and applied for that.
Oh, mercy.
I guess he didn't know it. But that's where I got my information. But people are, you know, now like that little kid, like Susan was saying, it does. It's horrible because now, people that listen to him and believe him, see, they believe that way. And then, like she said about the little children that are overweight, or even grown people that are overweight. I remember they had one time about this little boy that he was overweight, you know, and his folks just loved him, you know, but the kids were just teasing him, you know, at school, just tormenting him. And he took their gun to school one day and got up before the class and killed himself. That was on ABC.
Yeah.
That was probably 10 or 12 years ago. Maybe not that long, but anyway. I always remember.
But these
that.
No, these things have consequences. They really do.
Yeah, and his parents, you know, they just said, "Oh no, why did he do it?" You know, because they just adored him, you know. Yeah, people commit suicide that are adored by their parents. It's not, you know, people always say, well, somebody just didn't care, like Rush, you know.
Right.
Didn't fill their coffers with the right kind of food. But you don't, like you said, you get that mad cow disease sometime in your food. You don't know. We probably got Jimmy Hoffa. We probably ate him many times.
Oh, God almighty.
Well, think about it.
I thought I wondered if they found him when they destroyed the old giant stadium there in the Meadowlands.
Well, Alfred Hitchcock had a story a long time ago about a man that killed somebody, and he had a pig farm, and he ground him up with a sausage, and he felt like he had to go and buy the stuff from the grocery store so he wouldn't be found out in case somebody died, and didn't have DNA back then, but whatever, found a trace of that man in their, you know, waste.
No. Oh. Well, that's another one. That's another one of those Agnes moments when she gets her dander up. Don't you mess with it. I will feed you to the hogs. Yeah. She's not one. She is not one to be messed with, Juanita.
Yeah, good on her. Good. But anyway, that's basically what I wanted to say. I was going to tell you something else, but I'm going to wait to tell you another time.
Well, don't do it all at once, Juanita. Good to hear from you, dear. We'll talk soon, okay?
Okay, you take care.
All right, bye now. We're about to the halfway mark of the program for the evening. Wouldn't it be nice? Wouldn't it be nice to... Rush Limbaugh sitting there behind the gates of hell getting tormented for all eternity and just stand there with the ice cube. Oh, Rushy. Hey, Rusty Limbaugh. Yeah. Sort of put me in the mind of this. Sons of the Pioneers. Yeah, you remember Tumbling Tumbleweeds, right? Well, there was another one. There was another one. And we'll go with a different voice for this one. Because my son and my father both have really adored this man's voice. Here we go. Frankie Lane.
All day I've faced the barren waste without the taste of water. Cool water.
Water.
Oh, Dan and I with throats burned dry and souls that cry for water.
Water.
Cool. Moving, Dan, don't you listen to him, Dan. He's a devil, not a man. He spreads the burning sand with
water.
Dan, can you see that big green tree where the water's running free and it's waiting there for me and you? The nights are cool and I'm a fool. Each star's a pool of water, cool water.
Water.
But with the dawn, I'll awaken yon and carry on to water.
Water.
Water. Water.
Water.
Water.
Keep a moving, Dan. Don't you listen to him, Dan. He's a devil, not a man. He spreads the burning sand with water. Dan, can you see that big green tree where the water's running free and it's waiting?
Man, what a line. What a line. Keep a moving, Dan. That's a devil, not a man. He spreads the burning sands with water. How about that? Yeah, he's a devil, not a man. Who knew? Who knew Bob Nolan, the Sons of the Pioneers, back in 1938, would wind up writing about Rush Limbaugh? Devil. Not a man. No, I said I wanted to turn this in a different direction, or maybe not a different direction, but running down the same road with a couple of, a couple of tangents along the way. This morning, I went to the Opinionator, had my attention drawn to the Opinionator blog on the New York Times. It is an email or texting dialogue between David Brooks and Gail Collins. And if you ever wanted to hear what ugly Americans sounded like, this is it. David Brooks. See, David Brooks is no different. I don't care that he knows which fork to use on the shrimp. There's not a dime's bit of difference between David Brooks and Flush Flimball. They are from the same sleazy stock. And this dialogue begins as follows. Gail, I'm writing this from the back seat of a taxi in the city of Broad Shoulders, the hog butcher of the world, the second city, Chicago. I'm at the 2000 block of Damon Avenue, if you must know. Gail Collins writes back, well, I do appreciate specificity. Say hi to Chicago for me. I love Chicago. Hog butcher to you, maybe, but when I was in college, I found Chicago the most glamorous city in the world. This may have had something to do with the fact that I was going to school in Milwaukee. David Brooks. I've always thought of Chicago as the most American of cities, and yet these days I'm slipping out of my American skin in order to fully enjoy the World Cup. So today I'd like to ask you about American parochialism, whether you think we Americans are getting more parochial, and whether this is a problem. David Brooks. Did you say more parochial? As in, we used to be citizens of the world, but now we aren't? I don't know where you're going here, David, but when I was a youth in the Mesozoic era, nobody I knew had ever been out of the country. Now it's my strong impression that 90% of all college students are spending their junior year abroad. Plus, of course, so much of the rest of the world has moved here that you can find a Cambodian community in Cincinnati and Bantus in Bangor, Maine. But you want to talk about the World Cup, right?
The World Cup calls this parochialism to mind because soccer is not just a sport. It is an entire mentality. We in this country prefer pastimes that are rational and quantifiable. Football plays can be drawn up in a playbook, and baseball lends itself to statistical analysis. But the rest of the world follows a sport that rewards resilience and neuroticism. Soccer is a sport perfectly designed to reinforce a tragic view of the universe. Because basically it is a long series of frustrations leading up to near certain heartbreak.
And it goes on like, you know, what a supercilious prick. Can I say prick on the internet? I think I just did. He continued.
Soccer is a sport that rewards neurotic creativity. Many of the greatest players have been marginally insane. Yeah, because Pac-Man Jones is a paragon of sanity, right? Mark the Bird Fidrich was nailed right down to the ground. You know, dumbass David Brooks, create the line between creativity and sporting genius and physical prowess, the lines blur. There are, and that's the problem. You know, David Brooks is watching a world go away from him with a sort of profound existential Doppler effect as it goes on by him in his pretty little white world. And he likes hard black lines. What we find out more and more as a species on this planet is there aren't very many of those things. There aren't many hard and fast rules. There aren't very many black lines that are clearly demarcated in our universe.
When I first moved to Europe, back when Germany was winning World Cups, anybody want to look up how many World Cups Germany has won? I don't know when David Brooks lived in Germany, but I'm guessing there aren't 2 8-year spans where it was Germany in the World Cup, was it? Somebody will figure this out for me. When I first moved to Europe, back when Germany was winning World Cups, it took me a while to learn how to see the game as a series of constantly reorganizing spaces. It makes it sound, God, he makes football sound like feng shui. But as I assimilated to the European mindset, 6-week vacations, jambon, fromage, etc., I began to get a feel for what was going on. So to me, the World Cup is a chance to enter a different mentality without having to adopt all the other European motifs like hating Israel.
What? Huh? What? Where did Israel come into this? Is Israel in the World Cup? I checked. They're not. Can we not have a... No. Because, see, he's so much above it all, and he needs a moment to do some shilling for Israel in the middle of a discussion about soccer in the World Cup, for Christ's sakes. Of course, if Israel was in the World Cup, if they didn't start every game up one goal and the other side kicking a half-flat ball, we would David Brooks would scream that the World Cup, that FIFA was anti-Semitic. There's no difference between the way David Brooks talks about the world and the global poor, if you will, because, you know, a lot of us watch sport because it is a diversion from our otherwise everyday, ordinary, and sometimes desperate lives. Think, this is worse than George Will writing about baseball. God almighty!
Thinking about soccer also gives me a chance to reflect on the fact that we Americans have relatively few chances to fully participate in non-American culture. Back in the 50s and 60s, people who considered themselves sophisticated went to Swedish movies and knew all the top French directors. It was important to know what novels were being read in Paris. Intellectuals went to meetings of, say, the Congress of Cultural Freedom, which were international associations on cultural matters.
All this insight is striking David Brooks because of a cab ride in Chicago? Somebody get the guy a hot dog.
Since then, the world has globalized more. You see, American culture has pervaded other nations. But other nations' cultures have become less salient here, except when it comes to food. So this is my month to be a citizen of the world and suffer through an unfair, neurotic sport with everyone else.
What an egomaniac. What a piece of crap. He refers to soccer, known to the rest of the world as football, because there's a ball and feet involved, as a European sport. Excuse me? Does dumbass David Brooks even know where the World Cup is being held this year? Hello? South Africa? Sheesh. I wonder if he even knows it's you know, winter down there. Or almost winter. My God, it's almost July. Why are they wearing long sleeves in Johannesburg? It's astonishing. It is astonishing to see how clueless and how condescending our betters can be. Consider what was recently said by BP executive Bob Dudley on Greta Van Susteren's show, I guess last night, where he said, "Well, Greta, I know that oil companies are not popular." Yes, he sounds like David Brooks, too. I'm not up to a new accent right now. "Well, Greta, I know that oil companies are not popular. It has been that way for some time in the U.S. It's a company made up of people, many of which live along the Gulf Coast, that are integrated into the fabric of the communities there. We have 23,000 people in the U.S., many of which are around the Gulf Coast. I think, and everyone is devastated by what has happened today, I think I would look at some of the process today as just making sure that through that sentiment we don't actually shoot the dog who is trying to bring home the bone and meet its obligations all across the Gulf, and we're going to be there a long time." Jesus Christ. Horse's ass Bob Dudley doesn't realize that the American English euphemism or idiom to throw somebody a bone means to give them little or nothing. But there was an apology. Got to find his name here. Come on. BP chairman Carl Henriks Vanberg. He said, "I spoke clumsily when I called those hurt by this company's oil spill small people. What I was trying to say is that BP understands how deeply this affects the lives of people who live along the Gulf." Which, by definition, therefore means that the people who live along the Gulf are still small people. Well, you know what? I like small people. I would rather hang out with small people than David Brooks or any of, or Bob Dudley or Mr. Thunberg any day of the damn week. And I got a little reminder in that today because Agnes and I went scouting earlier today for materials to accomplish the septic system, you know, which David Brooks and Thunberg and Mr. Dudley don't ever have to contemplate. They just call some brown person to come and install one for them on the cheap. But we were out scouting and pricing materials and buying some materials and, you know, laying in stuff. I'm trying to make this as cheap as possible by sort of contracting the materials myself so I don't get burnt by the guy, by the installer. Maybe I'm doing that the wrong way. I don't know. This is all new to me. But on a lark, I looked at Agnes and I said, "Hey, honey." And I looked down, checked the time. I said, "Oh my God. France and Mexico are playing right now." And we were in a shopping center that had a Mexican restaurant in it. I said, "Come on, it's hot. We'll go in, we'll have some chips and salsa, and we'll watch a little bit. No better place to watch."
because my sympathies and my sentiments were squarely and clearly with the Mexican club. When I'm not rooting my country, I root my continent. It's kind of like the way I was raised on baseball. I was raised to be a Cincinnati Reds fan. If the Reds didn't win, if the Reds weren't going to the World Series, I rooted for whoever the National League team was because we were National League people. So I root my country in the World Cup, then I root my continent. David Brooks doesn't even realize that there are five teams from Africa. It's a European sport, and it's highly neurotic and Freudian. Huh? And I just happened to walk in, and it was a beautiful thing. We got our chips and salsa and some drinks. And I made sure that I had a view of the TV screen because everybody in the restaurant, the entire staff, was watching that game. And they were watching with hands clasped almost as though in prayer, or gripped in fists, or standing stock still. The guy who was bussing tables would stop with his thing full of dirty dishes. He'd stop and watch for a few minutes, and nobody in the management of the restaurant said move on or told him to get with it, because it was understood. This was Mexico. This was national pride. This was everything that sport is meant to represent. And I walked up and stood with them and watched the TV with them. And when I saw what I thought was a French cheap shot and made a noise, everybody in the restaurant who was standing there watching their beloved Mexican national team turned to me and smiled. Because, you see, it's 2010, and we live in the world of SB 1070 in Arizona, and Whitey ain't exactly somebody you'd want to trust, even if you got to depend on him for your livelihood in your little Mexican restaurant somewhere in West Virginia. And when I groaned at the French cheap shot, it was smiles all around. And it was a beautiful moment. And you know me, I don't know why. Maybe it's because I'm a contrarian. Maybe I root for underdogs. Maybe it's because we're underdogs, all of us, when you put us up against our corporate betters. We're all underdogs. What did Warren Buffett say? There is a class war, and let me tell you, my class is winning. Yeah, that. But you know by this time, you know how my mind turns and twists and makes its own paths. And I sat there watching that Mexican team, who went on, by the way, I'm happy to announce, to beat the French 2-0. In what was very definitely an upset. Not an upset on the level of the Swiss beating the Spanish yesterday, but an upset nonetheless. France has problems getting out of this round now, and Mexico has 4 points. They played to a draw with South Africa and then won today, so that's 4 points. They're in good shape to get out. But I stood there watching the Mexican team in their green jerseys running up and down the pitch. And just because of the weird way my mind works, I looked at those goals and I thought, my God, there's nothing new in this. There's not a damn thing new in this. Everybody credits the English with having invented soccer or football. But back when the British, the English, back when they were scrambling and scrounging over what the wolves left with the buzzards, the multi-generational great-grandfathers of that Mexican team running up and down the pitch. Were playing a game decidedly similar, only about 50 times as mortal. They still exist, the ball courts of the Mexica Nation and the Toltecatl and the Olmecatl and the Tezcalteca and the various and sundry peoples of the Maya. The ball courts still exist. They have steep, sloped sides and a ring on either wall. And all we know, because nothing remained after the elimination and the genocide of those magnificent cultures by the Spanish conquistadores, all we know of the game is that sometimes it was played for ritual purposes, and the losing side lost more than dignity, lost more than a game. They honorably lost their lives and were quickly dispatched to Tonatiuhcan, the home of the warriors, usually by having their beating hearts ripped out of their chest. But they went knowingly and proudly in some instances. But the game, we know the game was played with a ball, a spherical ball, made of strips of rubber. Yeah, that's another one of those things we got from them that they had back when our European forebears were, or my European forebears were scrambling with the buzzards over what the wolves left. Strips of rubber wrapped into a ball. And we know one thing. It was absolutely impermissible to touch the ball with the hands. You could kick it with your feet. You could bump it with your hips. You could, contrary to modern football, ding it with your elbows. You could not touch it with your hands. And you could header it with your head, because the remaining sculpture shows us men wearing headgear, helmets, you know, in the 9th, 8th, 7th, 6th centuries of the current era, helmets. And the rule was that if you could dribble that ball up to that hoop, that tiny, tiny hoop, and hip it or elbow it or header it or kick it through that hoop, game over immediately. Otherwise, there were mobile goals. There were mobile goals at either end of the pitch. And you scored by scoring goals. It's all we know. What an amazing thing it must have been to behold, though. And I guess David in Tennessee tells me that the American side despises the Mexican team more than any other team in the field. Think Alabama-Auburn. Think Oregon-Oregon State. Think Army-Navy. Yankees-Red Sox. That kind of thing. But I stood there watching it, and I had one of those moments that felt like a little bit maybe like what Kurt Vonnegut was talking about when he talked about coming unstuck in time. Just a little bit like that. Because I was in the presence of people whose genetic stock went back to a day when that game was still played. And I'm not mythologizing or anything like noble savage, none of that business. All highly developed societies have an element of brutality to them. And none of them, from what we know of the archaeological record and the current record, none of them have ever been very good at being good to their poor people. But there was a continuity there for me as I stood there in that little Mexican restaurant, the aroma of beans and rice and simmering meats coming out of the kitchen, the occasional whirring scream of the margarita blender. No, no margaritas for Bob. I felt one of those little synchronistic thank you lanyap sort of moments, serendipity, if you will, that moment for me had to happen today because earlier in the day I had read that supercilious, condescending horse shit from David Brooks, who can't even talk about soccer without working in some poor, poor, pitiful Israel. Who wants to see soccer as a neurotic sport that manifests the existential ennui of the Europeans, and how it is a game that is predicated on heartbreak. Bullshit! In the faces of those people with whom I watched a portion of that game, and God, what I would not have given to have been there when those two goals went into the net for Mexico. In the faces of the people with whom I stood, I didn't see neuroticism. I didn't see agony. I didn't see existential ennui or hopelessness. I saw eagerness. I saw excitement. I saw nerves. And I wish there was some way, if I could have tweeted at that moment, I would have tweeted at David Brooks, next time you want to understand soccer, you jackass, get out of the cab and get into the bodega. Go into the tienda. And get the hell over yourself. But God, I love little moments like that. Little moments that remind me how profound this journey can be and the magic of it. And I don't care if this is our blood feud. Apparently the U.S. side has defeated Mexico when it screwed them out of world position. I don't care. I want to see the American side do well. But damned if I don't want to see the Mexican side do well. And maybe even better. Because in watching what I saw, I knew I was looking not only at generations upon generations and the full flowering of the fruit thereof. But I also knew that I was looking at kids who had started playing a game not on sweet, well-mown green grass, but on dirt and sand with a ball made of rags. And I was watching them whip ass on a world power. And very much like that passage out of On the Road by Jack Kerouac, where he talks about the streets of Denver by night and how frustrated he was to be how he wished to be anything but the boring white man that he was. In that moment, I realized that the people standing there watching that game, while not wealthy by any stretch of the imagination, but they run a nice restaurant and they're doing okay. But I watched them have something that all the money in the world that David Brooks possesses could never buy. I saw them connected to something transcendent and greater than themselves. And I couldn't help wondering if maybe David Brooks is the one with the existential ennui. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob, is that you?
That is me, Jim.
Oh, my goodness. You know, I was watching this program about the earlier forms of soccer as played by the Mesoamericans. And talk about a blood sport. Boy, that happened to be one of them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was. I mean, just even a friendly game had to be brutal. I mean, if you've got to be padded elbows, knees, hips, and head, because it was a hard, it was a hard rubber ball. It wasn't inflatable.
Absolutely, I don't know how much it weighed, but it was a very solid piece of rubber. And you know, when the players would impact with that ball, it left the. And I've seen modern representations of how the game was played. I mean, these guys didn't come off the field with bruises. They had hematomas.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, and you know, consider the steep slopes of that ball court with the one ring hung up on the side wall. How in God's name do you get the ball there?
I just don't know. I just don't know. How did he get the ball there? I just don't know. It's just that reminds me of something else that's just totally unrelated, and I better keep my mouth shut here, but it was something that happened to me a long time ago.
I will trust you and your judgment, Jim.
Well, years ago, I taught school, and one Monday morning, you know, when I came into school, well, pretty much bleary-eyed from being up for party time, wasting, having too much fun, I noticed that these kids were just deathly quiet. And I thought to myself, something is going on here. I guess I'll find out soon enough. And then it happened. One guy raised his hand. They'd been to some kind of concert with Rod Stewart. And they asked me, Do you hear about Rod Stewart? And I said, no.
Oh, no. No, not the... Oh, no. No, not the Rod Stewart story. Oh.
Do you remember that?
And then they told you, of course.
Well, I mean, what they said was that they had taken to the hospital and they had found all this material in there that relates to human reproduction.
Yes.
And I just looked at those kids and I said, well, how did it get there?
Oh, dear, Jim. Sometimes when you're in the hole, the best thing to do is to stop digging.
Well,
it sounds like these were young kids, and they delight. And I can tell you, insofar as I'm still raising a couple of middle schoolers, they still delight in trying to shock the teacher.
Of course they do. And I thought to myself, well, if you're going to try this on me, then I'm just going to throw it right back on you. And, of course, they all just fell on the floor, and I said, next, let's move on. But speaking of moving on, and speaking of turds in the punch bowl, what about that congressman from Texas?
Oh, Joe Barton?
Yeah, who apologized to British Petroleum for having them been put out.
Oh, it's sickening. And you know, what's even more interesting out of that is that even members of the GOP are on his ass over it. You know, of all the things they won't condemn, by God, this one they will. Representative Jeff Miller, who is a Republican from Florida, said, I condemn Mr. Barton's statement. Mr. Barton's remarks are out of touch with this tragedy, and I feel his comments call into question his judgment and ability to serve in a leadership on the Energy and Commerce Committee. He should step down as ranking member of the committee.
I think it calls on his ability to be in the halls of Congress, period. Anybody that make a comment like that?
Oh, remember, this is one of those sickening punks from Texas. He joined in with Michelle Bachmann some while back, Jim, when she was defending carbon dioxide as being natural and good for us. Well, yes, it is. It's natural as carbon dioxide. I don't know why we'd want to regulate the carbon dioxide. It's natural.
Well, I mean, maybe she should go into one of those villages over that was completely decimated by emissions from carbon dioxide that killed everybody who was on the ground as well as all their animals.
Well, I don't know if you remember, but a while back I proposed the reinvigoration of the manned spaceflight program with these carbon dioxide is good for you Republicans by sending them on a spaceship to Mars where they can breathe all the carbon dioxide they want to. Because that's the Martian atmosphere.
Yeah, I think that'd be a good place for them to go, and they could stay there, too.
You know, then maybe Republicans would learn about evolution. Who knows? Maybe these Repiglicans would evolve the ability to deal with it. Maybe they'd get gill slits or something.
I don't know. The other thing that I just wanted to mention was the conduct of the CEO before the congressional committee today. I mean, you know, Lou Costello. Remember him?
Oh yeah.
The one when they asked him if he'd done anything at all to serve his country, and he said, well, I paid my tax. And I said, you know, Costello had more intelligent comments and replies than this man who was up there absolutely lying to Congress.
Did they, I wasn't able to watch. Did they make him go to, did they put him under oath, Jim? Have any of these clowns been put under oath?
I didn't see the beginning of, I would assume he would have to be if he's testifying before a House committee. You have to be sworn.
You know what? You don't anymore.
Really? Well,
it's kind of sad. They don't. I mean, if you think back to the Iran-Contra scandal and stuff like that, there were those eponymous images of Ollie North in his Marine greens,
okay,
standing up there with his arm in the air and all of that. No. With the Bush administration, it became sort of gauche, I suppose. To demand that people like that tell the truth before the Congress.
Well, my God, what's the use in having a hearing?
Well, there you go.
And sworn to tell the truth because, you know, they can get in there and lie with impunity, which is exactly what this guy did. I mean, I have never heard so many, I don't recall, duh, that type of thing. And you could tell that the members of the committee were fixing to jump over their desk and throttle this guy. But honestly and truly, I couldn't believe that he actually got up there and just lied his ass off. Well, I could believe it, too. Anybody who would make the statement about getting his life back, I mean, you know, as callous and shallow as that is. And
remember, I'm being reminded myself, Jim. Remember, Joe Barton is in one of those. Do you remember when Tom DeLay was hip deep in the gerrymandering redistricting of Texas, and they pulled every dirty trick out of their hat that they could find? Do you remember that?
I sure do.
Well, Joe Barton is from one of those gerrymandered districts. It's controlled exclusively. It is a wholly owned subsidiary by big business in Texas. To the extent, I'm told, that he could even survive the live boy, dead girl test. There is nothing that would run Joe Barton out of his seat.
Well.
And Margaret down in Asheville is writing to say he was put under oath today. So I'm glad to hear that.
Well, I'll tell you, there were suggestions made that he be handcuffed, and also, if not handcuffed, that they put an ankle bracelet on him.
Wouldn't bother me in the least. You know, we do that to ordinary citizens of this country for far, far less. I mean, my God, if you recall the previous night's conversation, I think a couple of nights ago, Jim, you know, we are sending women to jail over $300 debts to a lumber yard. We do that in America now.
But, you know, I thought that was one of the primary reasons that the colony of Georgia was established by Oglethorpe, and that was to relieve or to...
It was to relieve overcrowding of the debtors' prisons in England, just as the colonization of Australia was. And after eliminating and criminalizing debtor's prison, we have quietly gone about our business of reestablishing them.
But how can they do that within the legal framework of our legal system?
Our legal system, Jim, is broken. A lot of this is happening, for instance, up in the state of Minnesota. And Minnesota has the most creditor-friendly laws in the country.
In other words, basically, the motto is, Fed lex, dura lex, the law is latex.
Bingo. The law is as good as the money you have to buy it with.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, little. There's so much work to be done. You know, if we could actually count on the teabaggers and those people out there to help us work on them, we might be able to get somewhere. But we can't, and we won't.
So this woman is in jail because she owes $300 to a lumber mill.
Yes, sir. And she was put in jail until she paid the $300.
Well, that seems just totally counterproductive because how can a person generate any type of wealth with which to repay the debt when they're in a 4x4 stony lonesome? That just doesn't make sense to me. Of course, half the world doesn't make sense to me anymore. So, I mean, you know, I guess why should I appear incredulous?
It's, I know.
You know, even in my emails, I've noticed a degrading of my own ability. I can't even spell words like counterfeit and rendezvous.
Yeah, but that's because you're typing on the fly, Jim. I don't think you're slipping.
I hope so.
But dig this. David in Tennessee noting this. He says two people at a Bush rally, and you know it happened, and it happened in Charleston. You know our Charleston, Jim. Two people at a Bush rally wearing impeach T-shirts pulled more jail time than will any BP executive.
I remember that. I wonder how much time they gave them.
They were in for a couple of days. It cost the people of the state of West Virginia about $1 million apiece when all the dust settled because it was so patently illegal. The federal government didn't pick up the tab. We did.
Just because of their illegal meandering?
No, just because of the T-shirt they wore.
That's what I mean.
There was nothing illegal about their meanderings. They were there by right because it wasn't a Bush campaign event. It was a 4th of July celebration at the state capitol grounds.
Well, I was referring to the people who locked them up, not them.
Okay. Yes. Yeah, exactly.
MW never could stand any kind of criticism whatsoever, could he?
No. And, of course, Dick Cheney has recently crawled out of the coffin to come out and say that he didn't think President Obama was very presidential. And that he was screwing up the BP disaster because, he pointed to the president's lack of action in the Gulf oil leak, and he said Obama doesn't have enough executive experience or experience in Washington to make things happen.
Well,
you got to admit, it takes the ones that are made out of pure, right, just solid brass to say something like that.
I mean, after the stunts he pulled and two wars and also his own personal conduct in the well of the Senate with Senator Leahy, he has the gumption to make accusations? Of course he does. That's just the kind of person he is. He's just a non-person, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, he's a person who needs to be wearing one of those aforementioned ankle bracelets, as far as I'm concerned.
I wonder where he is now.
Well, where he was when he made this sleazy comment was, let me check real quick. I had it right in front of me. He was giving a speech of more than 1,200 people in a sold-out audience at the Manufacturer and Business Association Convention in, ironically enough, Erie, Pennsylvania.
Oh, gosh, I wish I lived in his neighborhood because Halloween would be an evening that I would look forward to all year long.
How could you? Oh, that would be. I know the kind of sense of humor you have, Jim. Yeah.
Oh, listen. The first thing I would do would be to take all of the lug nuts off the wheels of his car. Now, that actually happened to a teacher of mine when I was in high school.
And you had absolutely nothing to do with it?
No, I didn't. But this...
Just making sure everybody understands that.
But this guy, this teacher that I had, and I was in like the eighth grade, and all eighth grade boys had to take shop. And the girls took home ec, okay? And he came into school one day and said this, "Boys, I can truthfully say that I have never had sex with a Negro woman," just out of the blue. And some guy stood up in the back and said, "Well, you don't know what you missed."
Lord of mercy. Growing up in South Carolina.
Mother. And my mother said, "Would you please repeat to me slowly what you just said?" And so when my dad came home from his office, I noticed he went into his study with the door closed, and I could hear the phone being dialed. And a word of prayer was held between him and that teacher, that's for sure.
A word of prayer.
Exactly. I mean...
And, you're South Carolinian that you are, I'm being reminded, in the course of that mention of the T-shirts, I'm being reminded of a gentleman by the name of Brett Bercy. David in South Carolina writing in to remind me of this.
I knew him.
Well, he was the one whose conviction for a protest against George Bush was upheld.
Yeah, he's an old agitator from way back to the no nukes days.
Well, no, beyond that, 1969, he got 2 years in prison for spray painting "Hell No, We Won't Go" on the wall of his draft board office.
Yeah, I remember Brett.
You know what, we fail to remember civil liberties excesses in terms of how they were suppressed of the Bush administration at our peril, because one of the sad facts is that the Obama administration is going further. Now, granted, they're letting the teabaggers wear their guns to Obama appearances, and you can carry placards of him dressed, done up as Adolf Hitler all you want to, you know. But by God, if as we learned with the WikiLeaks case, if you've got information that is deleterious to the American position, that no, we are not murdering, we did not murder journalists in Iraq, when in fact, you know, the video shows that we clearly did, well then, you will be pursued to the highest degree of the law. And then this, Jim, let me also share this with you. A story out of the L.A. Times that I found over at BartCop.com that just made me crazy. A man known as the Prince of Pot, who sold seeds all over the world for growing marijuana plants, cannabis plants, named Mark Emery, was extradited at the request of the Obama administration Department of Justice, the U.S. Attorney in Seattle. He had committed no crime on Canadian soil, and arguably no crime on American soil, except the one that the overzealous the U.S. Attorney in Seattle concocted. Had him extradited from Vancouver to Seattle, and the guy is doing 5 years now.
For what, manufacture?
Yes, sir.
Oh, my God, don't we have better things to do?
Well, you know, the Bush administration went after Tommy Chong for Chong's bongs and put him in prison. And now this clown in Seattle has nothing better to do than go after a guy who sells pot seeds. Not even pot plants, pot seeds. And the United States demanded that Canada turn him over, and Canada did. It's shameful for us, and it is more shameful for the Canadians for knuckling under to us once again. And this the problem with this, Jim, is the fact that it comes after there was an announcement early on in the Bush administration
by the Bush, see, I keep doing it, by the Obama administration, early in the Obama administration, that the Obama administration DOJ would take a sane and sensible approach to cannabis.
Well, one would think so. My God. I mean, even back during the days when Richard Nixon was president, I had a bong that it was such, the pneumatics were so powerful that it actually had stirrups that you put your feet in.
Dear God.
Let me shut my mouth. I mean, I'm speaking out of school.
Did it have some? Did it have some sort of air compressor pump on it? Or did, no. I'm not asking. I don't do that anymore.
It did have an aquarium motor on it.
Son of a gun. And stirrups.
Well, you had to have stirrups because.
Well, you realize that you're creating massive either flashbacks, wistful thoughts. And in some cases, envy out there right now, don't you, Jim? You know that, right?
Well, God, I hope so. I mean, you know, it's like Mae West said, there was a time when I was ashamed of the way I lived. A reply, well, did you reform? Her reply was, no, I just got over being ashamed.
Here, here, Jim, here, here. And you have a wonderful evening, my friend.
Good night.
Bye now. Stirrups. Stirrups, I tell you. Hey, welcome to the program.
Oh, dear God. This is, what am I laughing at? Jim is so inappropriate. It's unbelievable. You know what? From the broad steward through the sex with Negro women, and he topped it off with that last bit, bongs and stirrups, can't take it. That was hilarious.
And you know what? If I had John Stewart's team of writers, I couldn't get that on the air.
Shut the hell up. Listen, I'm sitting here thinking, should I really be finding this funny? That dude, man, that was classic. Shit. Anyway.
Yes.
I was like, wow, okay. So anyway,
I love it when somebody lays you low, Sandra. It's a beautiful thing.
That was great. The Rod Stewart, I didn't know why. I said, oh no, couldn't believe he was coming with that. That was because you know that story is so gruesome.
Yes,
and it's like
it's right up there with Richard Gere and the Gerbil.
Right, it's right there. Shit. Anyway, that was
And I'm ashamed of myself for mentioning that.
Well, you have to go there because it's all. Yeah,
but that's all that was urban mythology before there was an internet.
Right. No. Those stories are hilarious. Yeah. Anyway, so you know what? I wasn't gonna call, but you mentioned that son of a bitch, David Brooks. God damn it! Here's one more little intellection from him about the Duke Butler gang.
Oh Jesus!
Yeah, it's like. Yes, I was going to say that for the first time in human history, rich people work longer hours than middle class or poor people. How do you construct a rich versus poor narrative when the rich are more industrious?
You know, let's just lock him up in a room with George Will and let him prattle on about it.
No, he's disgusting. I mean... Oh, he's just terrible. So when you were talking about him, I just thought, oh, no.
And to work an Israel dig into it, that's the one that just knocked me out of my chair.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's another one of those. I mean, they're obsessed with it. And, I mean, the whole thing about how he was rooting for him, he was like one of the 10% that rooted for Duke, and wallowing in that.
Yeah, because he's proud of being, I don't know what. He's got a fetish for men with faces like weasels?
Listen, all he does is, he just goes on, eludicates for the rich three times a week. You know what I'm saying? He's a disgusting, I would never want to do what he's gross. He's foul. I can't believe every week in those little discussions he's had with Gail Collins. I mean, it's just.
Well, now I know I have to keep up with these things because, my God, Sandra, Really? I mean, is it, and see, that's the thing. I saw a discussion taking place in the chat room earlier about Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh. You know, come on, isn't that just their shtick? They're not really like that, are they? Yeah, David Brooks is really like that. Glenn Beck is really like that. Hannity is really like that. All of these asshats are really like that.
No, David Brooks is such an ass, though. I mean, it's just been years upon years of that. That's his whole thing. He is so foul. And he, you know, when he rolls in, with amongst the small people, you know, he thinks he's writing something that is relevant. And he is so not relevant. Oh, my God.
And the whole, you know, when I went to live in Europe, and I learned about jambon et fromage. Ham and cheese. You know, really, the New York Times are New York Times readers really impressed with his world weariness because he says jambon et fromage instead of ham and cheese?
No, it's too much. I don't know. He's like one of. He's like fully white, first of all, you know?
Yeah.
It's really no daylight between him and all that is white, as far as I'm concerned. And he's a snob. So he's fully white and a snob. It's just a really nasty combination.
And he's again, I think it's a function of the fact that his lily white little world is going by him.
Well, yeah, I mean, the whole sort of his grip on what soccer's about is like, are you kidding me? Come on, man. Yeah, you know, it was just hideous. And that Gail Collins, I don't even know how she can have those. Because, I mean, she's not too bad alone. I've read some of her articles. And
yeah, how does every response from her not come back, you know, @ David Brooks prick? You know?
Yeah, no, I don't, you know, I mean, I think she's holding back for sure because, you know, it's supposed to be some sort of, I guess, liberal conservative bantering. I guess that's what those whole little conversations are sort of set up as.
And of course, yeah, and he has to do the, you know, he gets to define, because he's the conservative, he gets to define the terms of the discussion, and he wants to talk about American parochialism.
And he's a man too, you know. So
oh yeah, sure.
That dynamic, and it's really gruesome, those conversations, you know. And sometimes when I'm reading the New York Times, I'm thinking, well, you know, why do I continue reading this paper? You know what I'm saying? Because between him and that neurotic Dow woman, she's lost.
Oh, did you see this? I know this sounds like... Well, no, that's what this is. This is gossip across the back fence. Did you read the last column?
No, I don't think... What was that one about?
That Barack Obama needs to stop with the number 23 last-second heroic shots.
Oh, no,
I mean, it was almost incomprehensible. And I mean, she has written some pretty stupid things. And, you know, Bart Kopp always says Maureen Dowd, the dragon lady, she hates everybody. But this latest one, I read it because he linked to it. And it almost reminded me of that old business about if infinite monkeys had infinite typewriters, sooner or later one of them would write Hamlet. This was a monkey in a typewriter, and she turned to work in for her own. I mean, there's language in there that is absolutely, it's absurdist. It's surreal. It is, God, it's waiting for Godot on a bad, bad day in the rain.
Oh, God, no, I mean, this thing about, you know, and you know me, I take issue with Obama, but Obama really is making some of these white people, they lose in touch with reality. He's driving them over the edge, because at least these sort of elitist writer types, they're all writing some shit. They have lost their minds about Obama.
The name of this piece, and by the way, she needs to get a new photograph. That's from, like, the late 80s.
Stop. It's
sorry, get me the saucer of milk for table two. That was catty.
I don't care that hair. Let's not start off. I was like, what's going on? You know, of course I'm thinking, bitch, you got money, go get it sorted, you know?
Damn.
Okay.
Now, so the title of this column, and I think, you know, probably in her contract, she gets to title her own columns because There's nobody working in any newsroom in America that would get away with a headline like this. Can the one drop the buzzer-beating number 23 act?
Oh, no. Oh, my God.
Does that mean? It took me 5 minutes to sort that.
No, I'm glad you read it. So you can tell me, because that just sounds like I would lose.
I mean, here's a woman. For God's sake, Sandra, here's a woman writing in 2010.
Shut up, yes.
And she says, of the many exciting things about Barack Obama's election, one was the anticipation of a bracing dose of normality in the White House. America had been trapped. Now, again, this is the column from 2 days ago, 2010. America had been trapped for 8 years with the Clintons' marital dysfunctions, disastrously shaping national events, and then trapped for another 8 years with the Bushies' Oedipal dysfunction, disastrously shaping international events. Really? On June 15th, 2010, we get that?
What? Damn, boy, these people are like, it's like a dog with a bone, isn't it?
President Obama was supposed to be a soothing change. God, it makes him sound like Preparation H.
Yeah, no, listen.
He had a rough childhood. Michelle once told a friend that Barack, quote, Barack spent so much time by himself that it was like he was raised by wolves. What?
Oh, dear God.
What did I tell you? It's monkey and typewriter.
Oh, no. See, that's I'm wincing here. That's horrible.
So it's unnerving now to have yet another president elevating personal quirks into a management style. How can a man who is a dazzling enough politician to become the first black president at age 47 suddenly become so obdurately, oh look, she used obdurately, so obdurately self-destructive about politics? And it goes on for paragraph after paragraph after tormented paragraph. And I guess I'm trying to find it. What she's getting at is she's trying to draw a comparison between Barack Obama and Michael Jordan.
Oh, what? Oh, wait a minute. Oh, my goodness.
I mean, doesn't she know that we're in the post-Michael era?
Yeah, and also,
he's off hustling T-shirts now. Really?
The Clintons, too. She can't let none of that go. I mean, does she write a column with... Anyway, how is she trying to make the connection? I don't even see it.
Well, she quotes from the speech. Even though I'm president of the United States, my power is not limitless. Obama, who has forced himself to ingest a load of Gulf crab cake, shrimp, and crawfish tails, winged to Grand Isle, Louisiana resident. No, I think that's supposed to be whined. Whined to Grand Isle, Louisiana residents on Friday. So I can't drive down there and plug the hole. I can't suck it up with a straw. Huh? And then the paragraph. Once more on Tuesday night, we were back to back against the wall time. The president went for his fourth quarter Michael Jordan down-to-the-wire thrill shot in the Oval Office, his first such dramatic address to a nation sick about the slick.
Enough to put you off your dinner. That's terrible.
Yeah, it's terrible.
It's terrible writing. It's very unappealing. Are you kidding me with that? My goodness, she needs to really...
Yeah, and as David in Tennessee is noting, as if Maureen Dowd knew the difference between Michael Jordan and Yogi Berra. And frankly, this column reads a hell of a lot more like Yogi Berra.
Oh.
Or Yogi Berra as told to Casey Stengel. This is...
Yeah. Terrible. The writing is horrible, though. I'm still... My head is still ringing from what you just read to me. Yikes. Can I have those few minutes back, please?
Sorry. Yeah, I'm... you let me know when you get yours, because I'm gonna apply for mine.
Wow, no, that's okay.
And again, you know, I guess we're working the theme again. We started the program with $40 million a year Rush Limbaugh.
Oh,
we
yeah.
eased eventually into God knows how many million dollars a year David Brooks. And this is the writing of a millionaire Pulitzer Prize winner.
No, and all we have to do is drop a few lines of Thomas Friedman, and I'd be set for life. Because he's another one that is whacked and, you know, just some rich whack job who gets the column every other day. He's terrible, too. I mean, I don't know if you've read him, but that, I mean, he's so bad that I was forced to read him for some of my international relations classes, if you can imagine.
Oh.
And he's terrible. He doesn't make no sense.
Oh, the world is flat?
Yeah, that bitch. I hate him. Because he's talking about gibberish. He's talking about, like, well, Toyota and the Lexus. But he don't ever mention that, hey, bitch, Japan protected their industry forever. He never mentions that, right?
Well, that's a little inconvenient for him.
Well, I brought that up in class because I said, listen, I'm not going to be subjected to this Friedman. Oh, I cause a real ruckus in my class.
Oh, I'll bet.
I was like, no, I'm not reading this shit. Anyway, that's another story. But, yeah, he, all those writers at the New York Times, they're really not very, she's horrible now. What happened? I'm sorry, I'm still stuck on what she's
saying. She is still obsessed with Bill Clinton. I think she has a crush on him.
No, I do think that there's some interest in the penis there, and I don't mean to be graphic, but I think it's about like that for that chick.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, you can see her, you know, you can see her looking in the mirror. He went after Monica, but look at me. What's wrong with me?
Well, you know what? She leaves herself open for that. You know what I'm saying? I don't have no sympathy at all. I think that she...
And then she penned that column a book or something about not being able to find a boyfriend?
Yeah, some madness. Yeah, it's like that. You know, she lays it all out, so she leaves it...
Honey, go hang out in a bar.
No, it's terrible.
Maybe take some of that relationship advice from Pat Robertson.
Oh.
You know, the one where you put on your slutty clothes.
Oh, God, and do multiple blowjobs. I mean, I know he didn't say that.
But... No, but he damn near did. It was precious. I mean, what?
You go over there to the other one. Didn't he say something?
Yeah, that's what it was. Yeah, come here. I've got it. Here it is.
Oh.
Yeah, the quote is, it's exquisite. But you need to not drive him away or start hassling and hammering on him. But make yourself as beautiful as you can, as fun as you can, and say, let's go out here, let's go there, let's go to the other thing.
Yes, blowjobs on demand. That's what it is.
And for all we know, Rexella was under the desk by then.
Oh, hell yes. You know what I'm saying?
I hate myself, Sandra.
She convinced 2,000 pounds. I imagine that's still going, too.
Woo!
Oh,
man, that's some milkshake. And don't forget, he's got the reason he still looks so youthful at the satanic age of 112 is because he's using his Sea of Galilee mud mask.
You know what? Stop. 112. He's probably makes potions with like sort of crushed blood diamonds mixed with whatever.
Well, yeah, see, Agnes and I sat down with the Netflix this morning just because we were feeling kind of kitschy, and we watched Dune.
Oh, yes.
And there's this scene where one of those hateful Rabans is thirsty, so he's got this little plexiglass cube where he crushes this little living, pitiful thing alive and drinks through a straw. That's Pat Robertson.
Right, that is. You mean that thing that's floating around? Come on, man. That's one of my favorite movies of all time.
Oh.
You know, we already talked about that.
Right, and Agnes and me are sitting there. Yeah, we're doing lines all the way through it. No, not those kind of lines. We're doing lines from the movie.
Oh. Yeah, I assume you talked about the... You're talking about the movie.
Yes. But with Jim on the program talking about bongs with stirrups and aquarium pumps, me talking about doing lines with Agnes ain't going to help.
Oh, dear God.
By the way, Jim did write in and he said, please thank Sandra for her response. Some people have been places and seen things. I've been things and seen places.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, that was a hella funny call. It was just so funny because it was kind of random. He was just, and then all of a sudden he would drop this, that, or another. I'm like, oh, my God. So, yeah, it was worth being on the hold for that. That was hilarious. I'm laughing, phones falling everywhere. I'm like, oh, dear God. But, yeah, that was...
You know, it's going to be so fun when we get Skype on you and we can do all this with video.
Oh, yeah, well, that should be animated, and hilaria will ensue, no doubt.
Yeah, we'll get, I don't know, we'll get the guys from South Park to do it all, so.
No. Hey, did you get a chance to look at that email I just sent you not too long ago at all?
Yeah, I did, ever so briefly, but yeah.
You know, that story about the CNN complaining about Obama's language was at a too high a grade level?
That's a beautiful...
Is that for real? Are there people... I mean, I couldn't believe... I said, God, I want...
Well, see, I saw the headline, and I mean, it just sort of... You sent it in on the quick, and I'm running down to the bottom to see... You know, this guy's name is... the author's name is Jason Linkins, and I'm running down... Jason Linkins works for The Onion. Jason Linkins is a brilliant young satirist. No, apparently this is for real. I didn't get much out of President Barack Obama's Oval Office speech on Tuesday night, but I wasn't left with the impression that the president needed to speak to us as if we were a nation of kindergartners. He says this following, CNN has talked to a language analyst who gets paid to analyze and catalog trends in word usage and word choice and their impact on culture, and they report that Obama was too professional, and now America is at a grave risk of not passing its midterm exams on the oil spill.
Well, and then he goes on about the unfortunate sentence, and you got to read the sentence that he's concerned about. I'm like, what is this? It's incredible.
He singled out this sentence from Obama as unfortunate. That is why, just after the rig sank, I assembled a team of our nation's best scientists and engineers to tackle this challenge, a team led by Dr. Stephen Chu, a Nobel Prize-winning physicist and our nation's Secretary of Energy.
Well, look what the guy wrote underneath. That's hilarious.
Yeah, that crystal clear sentence is so terribly unfortunate. Oh, my God. To connect with him, this has got to be, oh, please, this has got to be parody. Oh, I don't know if I can live in this world, Sandra, if this is not parody. Obama should have definitely said, oh, God, this is going to take work. Yes, that crystal clear sentence is so terribly unfortunate. To connect with Americans, Obama should have definitely said... I'll get there. Oil go boom. Me need help from big brains. I call the Chew Man on the ringy phone.
I think that's Jason.
And the right wing sends Limbaugh and Beck out to mock Malia?
Yeah, no. It's that article had me rolling. I thought, oh, no.
So, why? Well, you know, if you don't mind me asking, Sandra, where was CNN with their language analyst when George Bush was coming out talking like Mr. Rogers on crack?
That's what my next comment was. I was thinking, are you kidding me with this? Because I read the sentence not once but twice. And then I thought about OBGYN, you know, and spreading their love with...
Yes!
I'm like, where's your language expert then? Was that to our level? It's just, I mean, Obama...
Our enemies never stop looking for ways to harm America, and neither do we.
No, I really appreciate people supporting Obama just on the strength of this kind of shit. You know what I mean? God...
It's oil go boom. Me need help from big brains.
It's outrageous.
Maybe if there were some tribal drums in the background, sending the same message across the jungle canopy.
Oh, you know, I mean,
Jesus.
It is just so inappropriate too.
But I think this is really real because Jason Linkins is bylined as HuffPost reporting.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's a... No, it isn't. I mean, I think that sentence... He wrote that sentence making fun of this language person, but I'm stuck on the fact that CNN actually, you know, did that shit. It's incredible.
The follow-up paragraph after that, according to Payak, who is... Paul J.J. Payak is the language analyst.
Exactly. exactly.
He says the speech was written on a 9.8 grade level, you know, almost out of freshman year of high school. According to Payak, it's really, really important to speak in monosyllables and the metaphors of a simpleton. And he lives by his code, referring to the areas affected by Hurricane Katrina as Katrina Land.
Right! That just blew me away. I'm like, Katrina Land? You know, what?
Is this the sum total in a... No, it can't be. That transition cannot be could not have been had that quickly, Sandra. Is this Twitter? Is this what Twitter is doing to us? Is this the Facebooking of America? Is this because of text messaging?
No, this is you know, Winston Smith producing the word. You know, I mean, I read this biography of Orwell. I mean, listen, dude is like fast becoming my favorite ever because the shit is so on with Orwell.
Oh, and see, I can go in a different place. I can go to a different direction if you don't mind. I'm an old English major geek and a bad one at that. And maybe Paul J.J. Payak hates Faulkner and James Joyce and that kind and God knows the convoluted sentences of Thomas Wolfe. Maybe he wants Hemingway speech writing. You know, Manuel sat against the wall. Manuel drank his brandy.
No. It must be that because it certainly wouldn't be Thomas Pynchon. I tell you that. And
oh no, no Gravity's Rainbow, please.
No, you know, and it's just kind of I don't know what the man's talking about, and it's just really insulting and disturbing. It's like, what is this?
What does he want from him? That he speaks in bumper sticker?
I don't know. That's what I'm saying. It's like, give me a break. I mean, I'm quite happy that he's clear when he speaks. God, you know?
Yeah, I don't have a problem with his speech. I have a problem with the content.
Well, yeah, that's not, you know.
And maybe that's because I really am a hillbilly elitist, and I want to be talked to like I, you know, got out of high school.
Oh, no, I just want, you know, some spine, some backbone, something, you know. But I'm not going to be sitting here getting upset because he's not talking.
But what do you want to bet? I mean, if this is out there and they're paying attention in the White House communications office, what do you bet we never hear another bisyllabic word out of Obama's mouth again?
Oh, let's hope not. You know, I don't, that's a really frightening road to go down. But see, I'm like I said, I'm just sort of, you know, I sympathize that the dude can't win. At all.
No. Yes. No. And that's why I just want him to give up on this corporatism. I want him to give up on the conciliatory BS.
Oh, my God.
You know, again, we are, okay, it's 2010, so that means 40, 60, 70. We are 75 years from FDR's fireside chats. Are we to understand from F.J. Palak? That in the 70s, Payak, Paul J.J. Payak, are we to understand from Professor Payak or whatever he is, that in the 75 years since FDR sat down and did his fireside chats, I mean, my God, what would he like? What would he like? The only thing we have to fear is fear itself be rendered into. That's kind of complicated.
Oh, not to mention those charts that, you know, Roosevelt would talk about and stuff. You know what I'm saying? He was pretty. Now, he assumed that most Americans had a reasonable grasp of the politics, which was...
Yeah, I mean, this kind of takes me back to Churchill. You know, whatever it is that this guy wants Obama to speak in is something up with which I will not put. This is nuts.
Yeah, no, it is nuts, and it's just sort of, I don't know, I'm just thinking, I don't know, it just really bugged me. I thought, oh, no.
And while we're at it, no, you're right, Sandra. He can't win because that sentence, that unfortunate sentence, was too complex. And yet when he says, I'm going to kick some ass.
Oh, yes, right. Then all of a sudden,
well, then he's a potty mouth.
He's an angry, you know, Negro is coming out. Or it's not presidential. Is that what he was accused of being?
Yes, not by Jim Inhofe, no less. Who isn't exactly known for being terribly senatorial.
No, but do I need to send you the Dave Chappelle Black Bush? Have you seen that?
Oh, my God, no, I haven't.
Okay, I'm going to send that to you just for your own look and see. It's Dave Chappelle, he's Black Bush, and he's doing a press conference.
Is it as good as the Blind Black Klansman?
It's the same thing. And the best part is that, see, everybody is black, the CIA, everybody. And even Kofi Annan, he's there for real because he really is black. It's just hysterical. All right, I have to send it. I'll send it to you.
Okay, this will be a beautiful little postscript to the program after I close the mic.
Anyway, I'm gonna let you go, but I'll send that because you'll love it.
God, Sandra, what a wonderful call this evening. Thanks.
Okay, take care.
Bye now.
Bye.
Sandra calling from Sacramento and just struggling to hang on to what remains of her sanity. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's Kevin.
Kevin, hey, how are you?
Yeah, it's been a while, man.
It has been. How you doing?
I'm doing great, man. I'm doing great. I'm sorry to hear about your little situation.
It's ugly, but I'm hopeful. I think we're going to get through this thing. Thanks to folks like you.
I'm going to do my best to help out.
How is your world in South Korea? By the way, I'm curious. Has word leaked across the DMZ that North Korea has won the World Cup? That everybody else just surrendered in front of their greatness?
Probably, yeah.
You know, I figure North Korea being a closed society and all, they'll just print the newspapers. They probably printed them before they got on the plane. North Korea wins World Cup.
Oh yeah, yeah. But I get real news. The BBC.
Oh. So,
yeah. You know, there are two higher education institutions that need to be blown off the face of the map. It's Yale and University of Chicago.
I want University of Chicago done first.
Both of them. They have, in the past more than half century, they've caused more misery than any other institution I could think of.
Yale has the CIA. We have Yale to thank for them, because that was a bunch of bonesmen and the like. That worked out nicely.
The other one you got to watch out for, that one in Texas. I think it's Southern Methodist SMU.
Yes.
That's another one you got to watch out for.
Anybody willing to host the Bush Library.
But it's about time, you know. They need to blow them off the face of the map. Too much misery for them. But, I just want to call and touch base and say I'm still out here. You know, the thing is, I try not to, and this is no insult to you, but I try not to listen too much. Okay?
Because you're enjoying your life.
Yes. You know, sometimes I just got to shut down. But
you're in a new and wonderful place, man. I don't begrudge you that in the least.
Yeah, but you know, like every now and then I'll tune in, I'm starting a new life out here, but every now and then I just gotta, you know.
Gotta check in. But I understand, because you know, if BP hadn't destroyed my beach, that's my little fantasy happy place I go, you know. And if I was two weeks at Gulf Shores, and it hadn't been spoiled and ruined, I wouldn't go listen to me.
Yeah.
I would enjoy the vacation. They are needed.
But I'm beginning to think, though, that region of the United States, they are massacred. They must be massacred. Because they vote the people in. The people who they vote in are the ones who protect the element that destroyed the Gulf of Mexico.
Yes, without a doubt.
Yeah. It's the same thing with the coal miners, sorry to say. Yeah, I feel sorry for them, and I feel sorry for their families, but it's just, I'm going to say most of those guys who died had Bush Cheney stickers on their cars.
There's no way of knowing it, but it wouldn't surprise me in the least.
Okay.
And frankly, how many Bush, how many of the 11 on the BP Horizon rig were Bush voters?
Yeah.
I don't say that as any form of damnation, but you know, that's one of our problems, is that we don't understand that our voting booth conduct has real serious and sadly often deadly consequences. You know, the fact of the matter is, everybody who voted for George W. Bush, either the first or the second time, has a few drops of Upper Big Branch and BP Horizon blood on their hands. It's that simple.
Exactly. You know, because I'll tell you one thing, I'm willing to bet every beach along that shoreline went to Bush. You look at the voting district, I bet you it's all red. They're directly affected.
Oh, remember Baldwin County, Alabama, okay, where Gulf Shores, the beach area, is. Baldwin County, Alabama, is where they monkeyed with the electronic voting machines to make sure that Don Siegelman was not elected governor. So, yeah, you're absolutely correct. Mobile County, Alabama, darn straight. And all the way across the northern panhandle of Florida, absolutely. Absolutely. Kevin, I hate to say it, but I've got to roll on because we are at show's end, my friend. Good to hear from you, and I hope things continue to go well for you. And let us hear from you when we can.
Okay, brother.
All right, take care. Yeah. Bye now. Right. Kevin, calling from South Korea. Wow. Just wow. And that's the show for this evening. One last note, just because I know so many of you know him and think so well of him, as do I and Agnes and all of his other friends. Think a kind thought for Peter Godbold this evening. He is our IT professional and the host of one of the most amazing shows that's ever appeared on the Horn. If you ever listened to Strictly Confidential, you know he frequently referenced his canine companion, simply lovingly referred to as Doggy. And I got a note from Peter this morning saying that Doggy had passed away, cancer. And I was just filled with such a sense of sadness. So think kindly and think warmly and think well on the very, very wonderful, wonderful years that Peter had with Doggy. And think well and kindly of him in this moment of sadness and grief, because we lose our pets and we lose family. There's no way to get around it. We love you, Peter. We do indeed. Thanks to all of you who are contributing to make this process go forward and help save us. Thank you. It is so sincerely appreciated. I'll get to the Twain piece maybe tomorrow night. That would be more appropriate for Friday on the front porch anyway. Friday on the front porch is coming our way tomorrow. I look forward to it. Thank you to our chat room moderator, Lottie, to News Ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to our blogger, Texas Betsy, our Southeast correspondent, Matt Osborne, Osborne, Inc., OSBORNEINK.com, our op-ed columnist at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com, Reverbo of Cavalcade of Crazy. Thanks to John Fox, to Peter Godbold, and to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to my head writer, David, in Tennessee. Continuing thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ColeRiverWind.org. We'll start the program tomorrow night with some extremely good news on the mountaintop removal front. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you.
On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy!
I wasn't planning on it being a busy, busy, busy Thursday evening, but dadgummed if it's not. Warning to sports haters. You might want to go look for a test pattern or something for a couple of minutes, because I'm going to be dealing with some World Cup stuff here in a little bit. But you know what? When it comes to talking about sports, I don't think anybody talks about it quite like we do on the Horn. Because it's not just balls and strikes or goals scored or the how many strokes under par. Sport, as I have said before, is a metaphor for our existence. And I'm feeling kind of good this afternoon. I'll tell you why in a little bit. First things first, though, at 2 minutes past the hour, as we open up this Thursday evening edition of The Horn, an update on the ongoing effort to keep my butt out of the hoosegow. You all continue to amaze me. It was Wednesday night when I told you a little bit about the predicament that we find ourselves in here, being the heirs and legatees of a failed septic system and a little bit of good old-fashioned hillbilly feuding, I guess, with some anonymous rotten neighbor bringing the local administrative system to bear on us, necessitating the rather immediate need for me to figure out a way to install an entirely new septic system. You all are amazing. We crossed the $2,000 barrier this morning, and I went out and began marshaling supplies necessary to get the job done in the hopes of having this all taken care of by early July. Like you, in your good graces and your kindness, I'm going forward because you are showing me things that I never dreamed, things that blow my mind to consider about what all of this means to you, and magnifying and amplifying oh so much of what you all mean to me and, in fact, to us here. We have crossed the $2,000 mark, and I am stunned. So thank you. Thank you from the bottom of all of our hearts. I don't know what more to say. I truly don't. There have been a lot of sleepless nights and tears falling off of Agnes's face that made for some pretty grim days around here until I told you all about what we faced. And you have responded amazingly. We are far from the requisite funds to get the entire job done, but I feel confident that we can get the job done just the same because of the kindness, goodness, warmth, and decency you have shown. Just a couple of representative emails of what I've heard from you in the last couple of days. Karen from California writing, "Bob, I heard your show last night. I started listening at 9 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. Fell asleep close to midnight and didn't turn my computer off. And so at around 2:40 a.m., I heard you speaking about the trouble you're having with your county and the $5,000 repair bill that you have in order to keep your home and livelihood. Bob, you have many friends. The Horn is a community. Those in the community live many miles apart, but we have things in common that make us community. You, like it or not, are the leader of our group. Your wise thoughts and strong voice travel far. The community needs your voice to continue, and we, the community, need to gather together to support you to get that $5,000 bill paid. I do not know a person who is not struggling each month to crack the nut to make ends meet. My friends are like us, working-class folks, trying to survive these difficult economic times. And as we struggle, the earnings of the middle and low-wage earners continue to fall, and the rich get richer upon our weary backs. You were right last night when you said that the right-wing media have strong support from corporations that give them unlimited amounts of funds to do their programming. Sadly, here on the left wing, that is not the case. In the olden days, community would gather together to help raise a barn for a neighbor. I consider your situation the need for a barn raising by your community. The community must now support the Horn. We can meet the July 7th deadline that you have, but we have to do it now. I'm sending in a donation just as soon as I finish this letter to you. If everyone else does this, the funds will multiply one buck at a time. We need your strong voice and activism. My heart is with the Horn community. Best always, Karen, in Ventura, California. I read that and I passed the, I called for Agnes and passed the computer to her. And she read it. And she just looked at me and all she could say was, "Oh, Bob. Oh, Bob." That recognition about what it is to be a community, that recognition about what it is to be working class and know that we must stand together. What's the old saying? If we do not stand together, we shall surely hang separately.